Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Welcome to this historic joint meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and the Rotary Club of San Jose. My name's Rod Diridon, Sr., President of the Rotary Club of San Jose, and your host for this at the Rotary Summit Center in downtown San Jose. Today, we are very fortunate to have former Secretary of the U.S. Department of Defense, Dr. William Perry, and Commonwealth Club President, Dr. Gloria Duffy, who will share the latest very sobering information on the tipping point. Will terrorists gain access to nuclear weapons? May I now introduce Dr. Duffy, who's a fourth-generation Californian and had received her undergraduate degree at Occidental College, on to Columbia University for a PhD, then four tours of duty in Washington in four administrations. Most recently, she served as Deputy Assistant Undersecretary of Defense in charge of the Nunn-Lugar program, where she negotiated the disarmament treaties of the Soviet satellite countries. Dr. Duffy and Dr. Perry will come forward. They'll make their presentations from the chairs in the front of the room, and we'll then take your questions. And thank you very much all for being in attendance. The next person you hear speaking will be Dr. Gloria Duffy.
Thank you, honey. And thank you for working at that so hard. Well, I'm obviously delighted to be here to introduce my friend and colleague, Dr. William Perry, and the topic that he's going to address today. Also delighted to see the collaboration today between the Commonwealth Club and the San Jose Rotary, two very strong public service organizations in our community. Welcome also to Lee Perry, good friend, San Jose State master's graduate, I believe, and happy to have you with us here today, Lee. So in the midst of all of our challenges to restart the U.S. economy and to create jobs, it's easy to forget that there is a challenge even greater than that, and indeed greater than any other challenge that we face. This is the danger that nuclear weapons will continue to spread to more countries, perhaps to terrorist groups, and that the United States may one day face a much more hostile world in which the use of nuclear weapons is a real possibility. If one is dedicated and very successful in life, one may accumulate the credibility to take a stand later in life, sometimes a very bold and dramatic stand, for a principle in which one believes deeply. And this is the case with the wonderful gentleman here to my left that you're about to hear from today. Early in his career, Dr. Perry served our country in the military, in the army in occupied Japan during World War II. He distinguished himself then as a scholar and a business leader. He had a real Silicon Valley success story. He was a mathematician and engineer, and he founded and served as the president of the Silicon Valley electronics firm ESL Corporation, which created digital image processing systems for intelligence and reconnaissance, and therefore had a great deal of work during those Cold War years. He was called to national service as Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering for President Carter. He reached the pinnacle of his career in a role protecting our security and advancing our national interests as President Clinton's Secretary of Defense from 1994 to 1997. And he has provided leadership over and over again in his many roles. As Secretary of Defense, Dr. Perry led the effort to dismantle weapons of mass destruction in the former Soviet Union after the Soviet Union broke up. He led the NATO alliance in its transition to its post-Cold War configuration, and he concluded an agreement with North Korea that halted or at least delayed its nuclear program for a period of time. He has received the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and he does not like to talk about it, but in 1994 he was given an honorary knighthood by Queen Elizabeth, and he holds a dozen other medals and honors. Now in his 80s, Secretary Perry has decided to use the great credibility he gathered during these decades of distinguished service to point out the continuing and increasing danger of the spread of nuclear weapons and to call for the complete elimination of nuclear weapons from the face of the earth. Three other former senior U.S. officials have joined him in that effort. Former Senate Armed Services Committee Chairman Sam Nunn, former Secretary of State George Shultz, and former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. Singly and together, beginning with a now very famous op-ed article in the Wall Street Journal in January of 2007, they've been writing, speaking, and testifying before Congress, meeting with domestic and foreign leaders to move forward that bold proposition. As a group, they are sometimes called the Gang of Four. I've had the pleasure of working with Dr. Perry as a colleague since 1981, when we were both at Stanford as research scholars. He obviously a much more senior one than I. He was my boss, and a wonderful one, for 3 years at the Pentagon, where I implemented his vision by negotiating agreements with the former Soviet countries to dismantle their nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons, and then, in a very innovative approach to this problem, providing them with U.S. assistance to carry out those activities to see that they would actually take place. Today, I'm going to offer a bit of background on where we are in our approach to nuclear weapons as a backdrop to Dr. Perry's remarks. The U.S. first made and used nuclear weapons in 1945 to bring the war in the Pacific with Japan to a speedier conclusion, to help save lives that would have been lost through the type of protracted warfare that was then going on from Pacific island to island. When the wartime collaboration between the Soviet Union and the United States turned into a Cold War after the Soviets imposed their political and economic system on Eastern Europe, both countries began to escalate the development and manufacture of different types of nuclear weapons and their delivery systems until, at the height of the Cold War in the 1980s, the U.S. and Soviet Union together had more than 50,000 nuclear weapons. As was often said, this was more than enough to destroy humanity many times over. American leaders since President Kennedy and Soviet leaders since Premier Khrushchev recognized the danger of an unbridled nuclear arms race between the two countries, especially after they came within a hair's breadth of using the weapons during the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. Kennedy and Khrushchev looked into that abyss and started a process of putting some restraints on the weapons through arms control negotiations, beginning with negotiations for a ban on the testing of nuclear weapons in the atmosphere, which had been taking place up to that time, and that ban was concluded in 1963. They also recognized the danger of the spread of nuclear weapons as Britain, France, and China obtained nuclear arms, and as other countries like India began to seek them as well. So in 1970, a multilateral agreement, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, was brought into force, which committed the signatories to not pursue nuclear weapons if they didn't have them already, and if they did have them, to not spread the technology to additional countries. And in this bargain, the countries that already had nuclear weapons agreed to reduce the thousands that were then in their arsenals. With the Cold War in full swing, it was difficult to make progress towards these goals, but the U.S. and the Soviet Union did conclude a sequence of treaties which capped and then began to reduce the numbers of their nuclear weapons and launchers through the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s. In more recent years, with the demise of the Soviet Union, the nature of the threat from nuclear weapons has been changing. First, through a number of new countries' pursuit of a nuclear weapons capability. So first India in 1974, then Pakistan in 1998, tested a new nuclear weapon and began to develop nuclear arsenals. And with help from Pakistan, as you well know, bringing us up to date today, North Korea has developed a nuclear weapon, and Iran is pursuing a nuclear energy program that could put them in the position within the next few years to develop nuclear weapons. But an even more chilling prospect is now before us. And it is the one that Dr. Perry has been calling the greatest danger facing mankind now for the past several years. So let's turn to our guest, Dr. William Perry, to describe that threat and to share with us what he and his colleagues in the Gang of Four have been doing to see that the threat is effectively addressed. And then we can also discuss some initiatives that the U.S. has recently undertaken to mitigate the threat. Please join me in welcoming former Secretary of Defense William Perry.
Thank you, Gloria. I'm going to give you a personal perspective on this critical issue of nuclear weapons. I'm going to begin by answering a question which has been asked me by many of my colleagues. Sometimes they ask this question with a certain edge to their voice. And is, why is an old Cold Warrior like you working to eliminate nuclear weapons? The short answer to that question is because I believe that today the greatest security danger we face is of a nuclear bomb being detonated in one of our cities. And I believe that that danger is increasing every year. But you're not going to get away with the short answer to the question. I'm going to give you a longer answer, too. And for the longer answer, I start off by acknowledging that my views on nuclear weapons have been strongly conditioned by my experiences in the Cold War. I'm going to share one of those experiences with you. It occurred back in the late 1970s when I was the Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering. And late one night, it was about 3 o'clock in the morning actually, I received a phone call. And I sleepily picked up the phone, still really half asleep. And the voice on the other end of the line identified himself as the watch officer that night at the North American Air Defense Command. And the general got right to the point. He told me that his computers were indicating 200 missiles on the way from the Soviet Union to the United States. I immediately became fully awake. Now, that, of course, was a false alarm. And the general had already recognized it as a false alarm and was calling me to see if I could help him determine what the hell had gone wrong with his computers so that he had some answer for the president when he briefed him the next morning. I tell you that story to indicate to you that the danger of a nuclear holocaust was never, ever academic to me. I saw it really up close. Ironically, at the same time, I experienced this false alarm of an attack by Soviet nuclear weapons. I was responsible for the development of all of the United States' nuclear weapons, the B-2, the MX, the Trident missile, the Trident submarine, the air-launched cruise missile, all of them. I fully recognized the danger of these weapons, but I also believed at the time that it was necessary for achieving the deterrence we believed necessary to deter the Soviet Union. But after the Cold War ended, I believed it was no longer necessary to take those terrible risks and that we should begin to dismantle this deadly nuclear Cold War legacy. My first opportunity to act on that belief came in 1994 when President Clinton appointed me as his Secretary of Defense. And I made as my first priority doing everything that could be done to reduce the nuclear dangers. During my tenure, we actually dismantled 8,000 nuclear weapons, both in the United States and in the former Soviet Union, about 50-50. And we participated, we assisted three nations, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and Belarus, to go from nuclear powers to non-nuclear powers. To put that in perspective, at the time, Ukraine was the third largest nuclear power in the world. They had more nuclear weapons than the United Kingdom and France and China combined. And it was a country that was going through substantial turmoil, political, economic, and social. So we believed that we were really making a major move forward for us, not just our security, but the whole world's security, by getting them to agree to give up their nuclear weapons. So when I left office, I believed that we were well on our way to dealing with this deadly Cold War legacy. But in the last decade, that whole process has been reversed. The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which was signed the last year I was in office, was never ratified by the U.S. Senate. Russia and China today are both building a new generation of nuclear weapons. Indian, Pakistan, of course, have gone nuclear. And A.Q. Khan from the Pakistan program has set up a veritable black market in nuclear technology. And finally, North Korea has gone nuclear, and Iran is following in their footsteps. This is what the four of us, the gang of four, which Gloria referred to, have called the nuclear tipping point. We believe we are right at the tipping point, and if we go over that tipping point, it will lead to dangers much more dramatic than most of you can probably imagine. So that has all developed since the time I left office. Adding to that is that 9/11 has made it all too clear that there are terror groups whose objective is to kill civilians, and lots of them. And we know that at least one of those groups is seeking to get nuclear weapons. This is the background which led the four of us, George Shultz, Henry Kissinger, Sam Nunn, and myself, to decide some really dramatic action was needed to stop what we consider to be a drift towards a nuclear catastrophe, to stop the proliferation of nuclear weapons, to stop the nuclear accessibility to nuclear technology, to stop the building of fissile material, and to stop the easy access to fissile material. We believed that none of these objectives would be achieved by business as usual. No one of the objectives can be achieved unilaterally by the United States. It's an international problem, and it requires international solutions. But we believe that the United States had a crucial role to play in leading the world in this direction. And it was that background, then, that led the four of us to conclude that in order to make real progress in this direction, in order to take significant actions to reduce this nuclear danger, the dramatic step that was necessary was for the United States to declare its objective of eliminating nuclear weapons and leading the world in that direction. I must say, at the time we declared this and wrote our first op-ed, we did not expect much more than the usual kind of academic responses to the op-ed, and we were actually stunned by the response we did get from leaders and former leaders from all around the world. Groups of four like ourselves, gangs of four, have been formed in Germany, in the United Kingdom, in Italy, in Denmark, in Norway, in France, in Russia, in Japan, in Australia. So there have been a widespread international picking up of this movement. To the point of about a little over a year ago, these were what we call Track 2 initiatives, unofficial initiatives. And it's quite clear that the actions that are truly needed must be taken by governments. And then a little over a year ago, a miracle happened. And the miracle was precipitated by President Obama's speech in Prague, where he stated that he declares with sincerity and with conviction that the United States would seek the peace of the world and security of the world without nuclear weapons. We're a long way from having achieved that objective, and it will take decades to achieve it. But at least now, the issue has been risen from just academics and unofficial people speaking of the problem to leaders in government taking up the cause. I'm going to turn it over to Gloria now and ask her to describe to you some of the ongoing issues, some of the ongoing actions that our government and other governments are taking to try to move us forward in this direction. Gloria?
Thank you. Is this on? Yes, thank you, Dr. Perry. And also, let me encourage those here listening to write questions on the question cards, because we will weave those into our discussion here. Really stimulated by Dr. Perry and his other three colleagues in the Gang of Four, President Obama embraced this goal and started the ball rolling on at least four major initiatives to try to take incremental steps towards that goal of eliminating nuclear weapons. And the first of those took place in April, which was a new declaratory U.S. nuclear strategy, which said that the U.S. will not threaten to use nuclear weapons against countries that are parties to the Non-Proliferation Treaty and that are in compliance with their commitments through the treaty against the proliferation of nuclear weapons. So it was to essentially step back and reduce the U.S. use of our nuclear weapons to threaten other countries through our declaratory nuclear strategy. There are many twists and turns to that particular declaration and that policy, and either Dr. Perry or I could get into those if you're interested. Then the second major initiative of this administration was the completion of the new START agreement. That's the Strategic Arms Reduction Agreement. It's actually called New START, which was signed April 8th by President Obama and President Medvedev of Russia. And this is the inheritor to the various SALT and START agreements that the U.S. and the Soviet Union and then Russia have had over the years, but that had in fact lapsed over the last few years and completely lapsed as of December 5th of last year. There were no major arms control treaties between the U.S. and Russia in force. And what the START agreement did was reduce by about, I think it was 30% the number of strategic warheads and about half the number of launchers for nuclear weapons between the U.S. and Russia. So it's a 10-year treaty. It will need to be ratified by the Senate. There's obviously many leagues yet to go. There is some opposition in the Senate, questions being raised about how robust U.S. existing, the reliability of U.S. existing nuclear weapons are, and so on. So there'll be a lot of debate in the Senate, but hearings have started in the Senate. I believe Dr. Perry was actually the first to testify in favor of the treaty. There was something very interesting happen, which was the Nuclear Security Summit. This is the first time any group of countries have come together to discuss, and this also took place in April, hosted by President Obama in Washington, 45 heads of state from different countries and three international organizations as well, to discuss this the danger that Dr. Perry and his colleagues have identified, which is the possibility that terrorists will obtain the material, the expertise, and the technology to make nuclear weapons. It focused on the protection and disposal of material, highly enriched uranium, plutonium, the raw material, the explosive material that can be used to make a nuclear weapon, and measures to better secure and protect and dispose of more of this material that exists in the world, because there is enough material to make many, many, many nuclear weapons. So that took place. There was a communique from the summit, the Nuclear Security Summit, in which various countries took on new obligations, announced new inspections, new openness and procedures to protect or dispose of the material that was on their territory. And finally, the fourth initiative is a is a conference that took place in May, and actually an international conference that had been scheduled for some time to review the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And there are certain measures and agreements that have come out of that to try to better enforce and broaden adherence to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So that's a brief summary. What I would just say is that all of those initiatives are interrelated. They're a package of measures. The U.S. has come back to taking a leadership role in this area, and it has gotten the ball rolling on efforts to work to diminish the spread of nuclear weapons, to secure nuclear material, and to put in place new limits on nuclear weapons. So is that a good enough summary?
I would want to add one point to that. Gloria has described a set of actions underway by our government, which are going to require actions by our Congress. The ratification of the START Treaty, new START Treaty, which Gloria described, is by no means given. In fact, the last treaty which was submitted to the Senate for ratification, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, was rejected by the Senate. So a question often asked us is, what can you as citizens do? Why are we talking to citizens' groups? Because we believe that the first instance is we must raise public awareness. We have prepared a video that covers in more detail some of the issues I've talked about today. Maybe Gloria can show you that video. This talk is one way of raising that awareness, but I hope that what comes out of this is that 10 of you or 50 of you or 70 of you will feel so interested in this that you'll ask for a copy of that video and have your own showing in your own home with your friends and neighbors and have a discussion of the issues as a way of raising the public awareness so when these major issues come to the vote in the Congress, particularly in the Senate, there will be a public understanding and public pressure on the Congress to act in the right way.
This is called the Nuclear Tipping Point. It's narrated by Michael Douglas. And it has a lot of background material on the nuclear danger and interviews and discussion with Dr. Perry, Secretary Shultz, Secretary Kissinger, and Senator Nunn. And we do have some copies here for you. And as Dr. Perry said, we encourage you to view it and show it to your friends. It's a good education technique to understand this problem in more detail. And I believe they're sitting here on the head table, and we'll be happy to give you a copy if you'd like to show it to friends or view it yourself. Well, we do have quite a number of questions coming in from the audience. So let me just start with, I think, probably the key question that many here have. Thank you for devoting your retirement years to this noble cause, but is it really possible to put the nuclear genie back in the bottle?
Well, we cannot uninvent nuclear weapons. We cannot repeal E equals MC squared. So in that sense, the answer is no. A less modest but very important objective is, can we control these weapons so that they reduce to an acceptably low probability that they will never be used? And in the process of doing that involves, first of all, reversing the trends already underway, which is more nations building more nuclear weapons, more nations becoming nuclear powers, and easy access to fissile material in the commercial reactors around the world. So it's very long before we talk about ever getting to zero, ever having the genie put back in the bottle, there are 100 important steps that can be taken, each one of which can be done, and each one of which will make us safer. So we're focused on those near-term goals. It will take us 10, 15, 20 years to do the things we know how to do today, each one of which will make us safer.
I like the way that Secretary Shultz formulates this, in which he says, when the Voting Rights Act was passed, or when emancipation for women took place, it was not a perfect world. In other words, it was a goal that was being stated. And it put it out there as a desirable goal to reach. And if you don't put the goal out there, you certainly don't move any closer to it. The any any additional countries or certainly terrorist groups that obtain nuclear weapons make the world less safe for the U.S., less safe for our allies and friends, and less amenable to our policies and our influence and our ways of life. And any conflict that exists in a region, in the Middle East, between India and Pakistan, becomes exponentially more dangerous if there are nuclear weapons in the region. And as Dr. Perry says, there are steps that can be taken. At Stanford, the research and group that Dr. Perry is part of has done some very important work with India and Pakistan, both countries relatively recently in possession of nuclear weapons, especially Pakistan, that in the case of Pakistan adopted some very dangerous practices with regard to handling the nuclear weapons on their territory during periodic periods of conflict with India over Kashmir, shooting wars, essentially. And the handling of nuclear weapons in a conflict or crisis situation, or in fact, if a country's government is unstable and perhaps threatened, as Pakistan's may be at some point, due to Islamic fundamentalism in the borders of Pakistan, just having procedures to handle the existing nuclear weapons are extremely important so that we don't end up with the weapons being used in a crisis situation. How does the existence of Israel's nuclear weapons complicate our efforts to get Iran to give up their program?
It's even more complicated than that, because if Iran actually gets nuclear weapons, it's highly likely, in my judgment, that Saudi Arabia and Egypt and possibly other Middle East countries will follow suit. So we will have a fully nuclear Mideast, the most volatile region in the world, and now four or five of the nations all having nuclear weapons. I can hardly imagine a more dangerous situation. The ultimate solution to that problem, if it can be achieved, is a nuclear-free Mideast zone, which has been proposed, and which Israel, in fact, years ago has agreed to under certain conditions. We've never have been even remotely close to those conditions. But that is at least a goal to hold out. But I would say specifically relative to Israel and Iran, as far as Iran is concerned, Israel's nuclear weapon can give them good talking points. But I think their reasons for pursuing the nuclear weapons go far beyond the state of Israel.
Do terrorists now have access to nuclear weapons? How might those weapons be delivered on target? Two separate questions, okay. Really.
The second question is the easier one. You should not think about missiles or airplanes delivering nuclear weapons by a terrorist. And therefore, you should not think about missile defenses as being relative even to that problem. If a terrorist gets a nuclear bomb, it will be delivered in a truck or in a freighter. And it need not be specially well-designed for that purpose. It can be a nuclear device rather than a nuclear bomb, as we ordinarily think about it, and can be delivered in a truck or in a freighter. But nevertheless, it will still go off with enormous power. So it will be delivered by a truck or a freighter, I would think. The first part of the question was,
do terrorists now have access to nuclear weapons?
I do not believe they have nuclear weapons today. The danger is that they do have access relatively easily to fissile material. I do not believe that any terror group that we are aware of has the capability to build a nuclear weapon from scratch. But the long pole in the tent is developing the fissile material, the highly enriched uranium or the plutonium. If they could get the fissile material, then they could build a nuclear weapon. Not easy, but it could be done. And therefore, one of the important objectives in our program is trying to get better control of the fissile material that's around the world. It is generally good control, the fissile material used in weapons programs. But beyond the weapon programs, there are fissile material in reactors, power reactors, and research reactors, which could be used to make bombs as well, and that is not under as good under effective control. So one of our specific agendas, and one of the ones that President Obama has endorsed and was promoting at this nuclear conference, which Gloria was describing, was a way of getting better control of fissile material, agreeing not to make any more fissile material, and taking some of the material, the highly enriched uranium, for example, and blending it down to low enriched uranium from which bombs could not be made.
Our intelligence agencies obviously work to determine whether Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations are trying to obtain fissile material, technology, expertise to make nuclear weapons. They believe that some of those organizations are questing for these materials and technology. So as Dr. Perry says, they have not necessarily obtained them, but that is not because they are not on the lookout for them. And so what's the, as Dr. Perry says, knowing where all of the nuclear material is, trying to reduce the amount of it that is around, trying to better protect, physically protect that which exists, or trying to blend it down and burn it up in nuclear reactors is one of the safest ways, because that is probably the thing, that's the determining factor. You can buy the expertise. The Pakistanis have been selling weapons designs and, you know, spreading the expertise and the technology through this AQCON network. So it's probably the material that is the weakest link, and therefore the concentration on protecting it, decreasing the amount that's around, and so far and so forth. Another question. I believe our strength as a country has been our best security. In the eyes of Americans as well as the world, our strength has declined. Your comments.
That's a complicated question to answer, because the national strength has many different components to it. There's military strength, economic strength, political strength, social strength. In terms of military, we have, without question in my mind, the strongest military in the world today. And I do not think it has declined. We obviously have had some very substantial economic problems in the last 4 or 5 years, but we are still the greatest economic power in the world. So I think perhaps a more interesting question is, does the world perceive that our strength, that we have declined? And many other nations have perceived that the United States' power has declined. So even if the objective reality is not that's not the objective reality, it still could be the perception. My judgment, though, is that both our military strength and our economic strength are still greater than any other nation in the world by far.
This is a question about a different type of threat, cyber attacks and cybersecurity. Of concern to national defense, what is a greater or likelier threat, nuclear weapons in the hands of terrorists or devastating national cyber attacks from terrorists or other enemies? Nuclear attacks seem to be attributable, and we can counterattack, not necessarily with a terrorist group, but cyber attacks can be equally devastating but less able to know where they originate. Could you discuss this?
I would never minimize the danger or the damage of a cyber attack, but I would not compare it in any way with the destruction that would be imposed by a nuclear attack. We conducted, our group at Stanford conducted a few years ago a conference in Washington called The Day After. We had a group of experts on the subject pulled together to say, what would our nation do the day after an atomic bomb had gone off in one of our cities? And we postulated what that scenario might be like and how we might respond to it. The first thing we observed was that the nation was in no way ready for that and would have a very fumbling response to it. The second thing we observed was that any terror group that did that would surely follow it up with an announcement the next day. Not only did we have this nuclear bomb go off in New York, but by the way, we have bombs planted in five other cities, and we're going to set them off one a month from now on, unless certain demands are met. Now, that need not even be true. Maybe they only had one bomb. But imagine the hysteria that would cause if your city was one of the ones named as where the atomic bomb was planted, ready to go off. You can imagine the hysteria and the exodus from the cities and the crippling effect on our economy. So the 100,000 people who would be killed by the first blast is just the beginning. It's just the beginning of the catastrophic results of a nuclear bomb. This is, for me, a very depressing subject. I hate to talk about it much or even think about it. But it has to be done because people do not understand how substantial the consequences would be of even one nuclear bomb going off. Now, we are getting back to the cyber issue, our country, in fact, all countries, are highly vulnerable to a cyber attack. And each year we become more and more dependent on our information networks, which would be attacked in a cyber attack. So the economic consequences from a cyber attack could be quite substantial. And quite aside from the issue of nuclear weapons, we should be taking reasonable actions to try to minimize those vulnerabilities. I would not in any way, though, compare it with the consequences of a nuclear attack.
So getting back to that, the question of the probability of the use of a nuclear weapon in the U.S., there are several questions on this. Secretary Perry, in your opinion, when, not if, do you believe a terrorist organization will first attempt to use a WMD in the U.S., and what type of WMD will it be? This comes from Carl Honecker, Commander, U.S. Navy, retired.
Various people have tried to put numbers, probabilities, on the probability of it going off. I don't know how to put a number on it. I can say, though, on a relative terms, that the danger today is higher than it was 5 years ago, and 5 years ago it was higher than it was 5 years before that. In other words, we're moving in the wrong direction. So that's the first part of that question. What was the other part of it?
What kind of weapon would it be? And
I would assume it would be an improvised nuclear weapon. That is, the most likely way that a terrorist can get a nuclear bomb is not get the bomb, but get the fissile material and then fabricate it. And it would be a very crude device. But to put that crudeness in perspective, when it went off, it would have the destructive power of the Hiroshima bomb. So that's what we mean by a crude, improvised device. When it goes off like a Hiroshima bomb. In other words, 100,000 people would be killed, plus all these economic and social and political consequences, which I described to you. It would very likely be, though, an improvised device in a truck or in a freighter, would not look like the bomb that the military people use. It's always possible that a terror group would get their hands on one of the nuclear bombs that the United States or the Russia or the British or the French military have. I think that's much less likely. Much more likely is that they will get fissile material and fabricate a crude bomb.
I'm sure you all know the scales and magnitudes we're talking about. A very small nuclear weapon, such as very primitive, that was used at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, would kill hundreds of thousands or 100,000 people, but there are weapons with explosive capacity exponentially greater than that in the arsenals of the U.S. and the Soviet Union that would kill many hundreds of thousands of people or millions of people, plus lasting radiation effects, blast effects, firestorms, etc. So there's a scale at which the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs are at the bottom of the destructive capacity, and it goes up to some very, very large weapons.
And the Hiroshima, the Nagasaki bomb had a destructive capacity of about 15,000 tons, 15 kilotons of high explosives, which is a lot. And I said, and you all have seen evidence of the damage that would do. We have in our arsenal weapons that have 15 million tons equivalent. In other words, 1,000 times more powerful than Hiroshima bomb. And the Russians the greatest, highest nuclear bomb, the largest nuclear bomb ever tested was tested by the Russians. It has up to 100 megatons of destructive power. So it's really beyond our imagination as to what kind of destructive power that is. But any of you that have been to Hiroshima or looked even carefully at the pictures of Hiroshima, that's what a 15,000-ton bomb would do, and we have 15 million-ton bombs in our inventory.
Dr. Perry, do we have adequate collection exploitation assets to monitor nuclear weapons development, deployment, and terrorist threats seeking to use these weapons? I think this means intelligence capacities.
The first question on intelligence capacities is, can we monitor what the nuclear powers are doing with their nuclear weapons, how well they're maintaining them and controlling them, and how well they are abiding by agreements they've made, for example, the New START Treaty? And the answer to that question, I believe, is yes. Do we have intelligence which tells us what terror groups are doing in detail? And the answer is no. We do know, partly from their own statements, that groups like Al-Qaeda have stated a requirement to get nuclear weapons. In other words, the leadership of Al-Qaeda has called for their followers to get nuclear weapons. So there's no mystery on that. It did not require intelligence to get that. They told us that. But how good is our intelligence on whether or not they've gotten them is not very good at all. We do know that they have, various groups have tried to buy the fissile material. And we know that because we and Europeans have set up sting operations in which agents have offered for sale what was purported to be plutonium or highly enriched uranium, and people bought it. Now, happily, these were phony materials. They were not really that material that could be used to make a bomb. But I tell you that just as evidence there are people out trying to buy this fissile material.
Switching back to the situation with the rogue countries like Iran and North Korea, should military force be used against Iran if progress is not made through diplomatic channels? And I assume this means to stop their nuclear program from going in the direction of nuclear weapons. Should we use military force against Iran?
The first comment I would make is we are not or should not be close to considering that today, because we have far from exhausted our diplomatic approaches. The problem with our diplomatic approaches is that for success, they require an international effort. The United States cannot by itself muster the diplomacy needed to stop Iran. We need cooperation from Europe, we need cooperation from Russia, and to a certain extent, we need cooperation from China. It's only in the last 6 to 9 months that we're starting to get cooperation from Russia in that regard. And you stop to think about it, and I've discussed it with many Russians, an Iranian nuclear weapon probably poses a greater danger to Russia than it does to the United States, and they're beginning to see that. So I think we're starting to get cooperation from Russia now, but China is still a long way from it. It was just in the last day or two that the United States requested the United Nations put sanctions on Iran if they did not cease doing certain things in their nuclear program. And that was, the good news was it was passed. The bad news was it was substantially watered down, not just because of China, but because Brazil and Turkey were opposed to it as well, and they are both members of the UN. At this time. I mean, the rotating membership of the UN and Brazil and Turkey are on the rotating membership right now. So there's a lot of opposition to getting really tough diplomatically. That then leads to the question that you're being asked here. If they've really failed, would it be worth considering a military response? In the case of Iran, I would say that's probably an academic question for the United States. We're not going to have that decision to make, because long before we get to the point of considering that, Israel is going to make its own decisions. And they have already decided that they will not wait until Iran gets a nuclear bomb. They will make a military attack on their facilities. I've discussed with the Israeli officials. I think they do understand, as well as I understand, the whole host of downsides to that sort of an action, what you might call the unintended consequences of that action, and really don't want to do it. But their view is that if the international community, led by the United States, is not successful in stopping the Iranian nuclear bomb, they will take that action.
Thank you. I've often been asked that question. Could Israel take out the facilities in Iran? This is a bit of a different proposition than what they did at Osirak in Iraq or even in Syria, where they were much more primitive societies without the type of military and so on. So could Israel take out the at least two nuclear facilities?
It's a much harder problem than they've undertaken in the past. I would never underestimate the capacity of the Israeli military to do this if they were given instructions to do it. The objective result of such a raid would probably be not truly destroying the facilities and ending the program once and for all, but they could certainly set back the program a year or two as a minimum.
For those in our listening and viewing audience, this is a joint program of the Rotary Club of San Jose and the Commonwealth Club of California with Dr. William Perry, titled The Nuclear Tipping Point. Although a country may sign an agreement to decrease or eliminate nuclear weapons, do you really believe that agreement will actually be complied with, say, by a rogue country? So can we depend on any agreements we might reach with a country like Iran, say, or North Korea?
Well, I don't often quote Ronald Reagan, but I will this time. He said, trust but verify. And I think any agreement of the sort we make with any other nation should have a substantial verification provision to it. And most agreements have or should have a cooperative verification agreement where the country, as part of the agreement, makes available certain inspection rights. So I think the answer to the question is no, not without some very substantial verification. And in the best case, that verification would include cooperation from the country being considered.
So you mentioned how countries use other countries' nuclear weapons as talking points for their own weapons programs. Well, they're doing it, and so we need to. And, you know, the U.S. and Russia are often cited in that regard. Well, they have thousands and thousands of nuclear weapons. Our smaller countries say, well, we need them too, obviously. They're obviously a good thing. They believe these countries believe in them. And so when it comes to the signal that the U.S. and Russia are sending, this new START treaty is pretty important, that while it doesn't diminish our nuclear weapons to nothing, it perhaps limits some of the excesses, the many thousands of nuclear weapons the U.S. and Russia have. So we have this treaty coming before the Senate. It's an important signal to other countries as well as for our own military planning and so on. How do you see the debate shaping up in the Senate? What do you see the concerns of the senators? You all remember that a treaty takes two-thirds of the Senate to ratify, so 67 members of the U.S. Senate have to say yes to this treaty with Russia. So how do you see that shaping up?
Well, as you indicated, I have testified to the Senate on this already. In fact, the first two witnesses were Dr. James Schlesinger and myself. I gave an enthusiastic endorsement for why the Senate should ratify the treaty and lots of arguments and reasons they should consider. Dr. Schlesinger was less enthusiastic than I was, but he came down to the same bottom line, which was that the Senate should ratify the treaty. So the hearings are off to a good start. That's good news. The second bit of good news is I would judge right now that the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which is the relevant committee in the Senate for considering this will probably vote to send the treaty up to the Senate floor when the time comes. Based on the discussions and debate I got during my testimony to that committee, I think it will be a lively debate on the floor, and I know there are several senators that are enthusiastically opposed to the treaty and will do everything they can to stop it. If we do not ratify that treaty, the United States will have lost any standing it has in the world to try to lead us forward in this direction. So the ratification of the treaty, while it's not a sufficient condition for moving forward, is certainly a necessary condition. One of the reasons that the four of us are meeting with public groups just like this is not to increase public awareness, is because we understand that there are going to be very important decisions made in the U.S. Senate over the next year or so, the first one of which will be the ratification of the New START Treaty, the second one of which will be the bringing the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty back to the floor for another ratification vote. And these are just absolutely essential steps in moving forward. I have a pretty high confidence that the New START Treaty will be ratified. I do not have the same confidence that at the present level of thinking that the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty will be ratified. Let me remind all of you that to ratify a treaty in the U.S. Senate requires two-thirds plus one. I can't remember for a long time any issue on which the U.S. Senate would agree with two-thirds plus one. So this will be a real challenge.
Just to do the numbers briefly, the New START agreement sets a limit of 1,550 nuclear warheads for both the U.S. and Russia, which would bring Russia down from 2,787 and the U.S. down from 2,200. This is strategic nuclear warheads. There are tactical warheads and other types of nuclear weapons. So it would bring down by about 30% the upper limits of nuclear weapons for the two countries.
Gloria, let me just comment on those numbers. While I have endorsed the START Treaty, New START Treaty, and want to see it ratified, it can only be seen in my light as a step in the right direction, and a very modest step at that. The numbers you quote are not the total number of nuclear weapons that the United States and Russia have. They're the number of weapons deployed. They do not include thousands more weapons in reserve. They do not include thousands more weapons in the so-called tactical nuclear weapons. Now, the word tactical nuclear weapons is almost a misnomer. The smallest tactical nuclear weapon we have is the size of the Hiroshima bomb. So, I mean, these are hugely destructive warheads right now. I'm sorry, the size, I mean the destructive power.
It's time already for the last question. And I would just ask you, you're speaking to a number of public groups. Rotary is obviously a big network around the country and so on. What can groups like Rotary and other community groups do, as one questioner puts it here, to support the work of the wonderful Gang of Four?
Spread the word. And if there are a few hundred people in the room tonight, if only 40 or 50 of these people would decide themselves to take some initiative, to get one of these videos, to call in your neighbors and friends and show the video to them, have a discussion about it, then we can take a few hundred people and compound it to a few thousand. And then if those people do the same thing, we get up to 20,000. And the number builds up geometrically. We have to get the word out, and this is a way of doing it, of getting the grassroots support from the ground up. But it requires a response on your part for this to happen.
So I'd like to thank Dr. Perry for the work that you're doing and for being with us here today, and obviously to thank all the Rotarians for listening to this, and pass the gavel back to my dear husband, Rod Diridon.
Thank you, Dr. Duffy. I hope you've all enjoyed this afternoon's program. And it's been brought to you by the Silicon Valley Commonwealth Club and San Jose Rotary. And thanks again to Dr. Perry, former U.S. Secretary of Defense, Dr. Gloria Duffy, President of the Commonwealth Club of California, and our audience here in San Jose and on the radio. We're now, this joint meeting, this historic joint meeting of San Jose Rotary and the Commonwealth Club, each of which is celebrating 100 years of service to the community and enlightened debate, is adjourned.